Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special Soleri report. This one's going to be public. We want it to go far and wide. We are bringing on a man who needs no introduction here, Robert F. Kennedy, chairman of Children's Health Defense, attorney, litigator, and amazing leader now in the fight for democracy and freedom. And he has a best-selling book, which is a blockbuster. I just got 10 more copies. I'm giving these away like candy at Halloween. You have to read it. You have to read it. It's called The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health, which is what we're going to be talking about tonight. And this is a runaway global bestseller. I can't tell you how many friends I've made because I've agreed to send people copies who are trying to get it and couldn't get it. So tell us, just give us a second and tell us how the book is doing in terms of sales.
It's doing very, very well. I think it's in its 10th or 12th printing now. We've sold in all formats over 600,000 copies.
Ah, fabulous.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. And there's been not a single mainstream newspaper has reviewed it. We are blocked from promoting it on social media. And even the ads, you know, paid ads for the New York Times are heavily, heavily censored. We bought one ad with them. But despite all of that, the book just keeps on selling. So I'm very, very happy. I couldn't be more happy. And I think a lot of people are reading it. And I think it's very helpful to people to understand kind of the narrative, the counter narrative. Give a real skeleton to and a history, how we got where we, you know, with these two strange years where liberal democracy and constitutional rights basically experienced this coup d'etat,
right,
that seems so organized and orchestrated and bewildering. And you know, I think it gives people a framework for understanding how that happened.
So it, I love the word framework because it absolutely gives a framework of a coup and how the medical cartel inside of that coup is helping to engineer that coup and connects the dots to lots of different parts of it. And the thing that has worked the best about the book from my point of view is it just cuts through what I call the fog of war. People who couldn't fathom it and couldn't connect the dots before read this book. And these are people who normally, if you ask them to read a book, won't read a book, but they read this book and then they get really mad. They get clear and they get mad and they take action. And that's the beauty of it. It converts them from a passive observer who's befuddled to somebody who's clear and will take action. And so I just ask everybody listening to this, please buy this book, read it if you haven't read it. I complained to you, you know, I thought, why do I need to read, you know, a long book on Fauci? I got it on a Saturday morning. I thought, I'm just going to read a few chapters. I couldn't put it down. I read all day, you know, into early evening, and that was my Saturday. It was gone.
And I apologize. You know, one of the extraordinary features of the pandemic was what I call information chaos,
right.
So which appeared purposeful. And right. We were deluged with, you know, all this fear data and fear porn, but none of it made any sense. Even,
right.
You know, it was vacillating, it was contradictory. The CDC admitted that 96% of the people who were listed as dying from COVID had four other comorbidities. And yet they didn't give us any framework for understanding the real risk of
right.
COVID and the very, very heavily stratified risk.
Right.
So that certain age groups had a terrible, terrible mortalities from this disease. It was deadly to to people who were over 70. It was more deadly to people over 70, 1,000 times more deadly than to people under 70. And yet those data were never stratified. They were never explained. There was deliberate confusion in the way that, you know, death certificates were manipulated. All of the data, you know, of course, the vaccine data were heavily manipulated.
Right.
We just didn't get clarity. And one of the primary functions, and I make this point in the book, of a public health service during a pandemic is to produce really clear data upon which rational policy decisions can be based. And right. That was never done. That was the initial.
It was the opposite.
Right. It was right. All deliberately confused, just, you know, this chaotic information barrage that nobody can make any sense of. And of course, the networks were making billions of dollars promoting fear. So it allowed them to use all of the data opportunistically to push their agenda.
Right. And I will say this, that was in the period when you started the Defender and at Children's Health Defense. And that was one place we could always go to get the straight story. And it helped tremendously. It helped us a lot. Before we go on to the global war on health, I just wanted to ask you one question. I just got 10 new copies of the book. As I said, I'm giving them out like candy. But I was told today that there's a new edition coming and translations coming. Could you just fill us in on that?
Well, there's translations now, I think, in French, in Dutch, in Italian, Spanish, and a number of other languages that should be coming out any day now.
Okay.
There's also a new edition that will be published in March that has the chapter, a new chapter, a really explosive chapter on the Wuhan lab. Huh. That shows exactly what happened with, you know, the history of this, of Tony Fauci's very, very sinister history, and his ties with the military, the intelligence agencies, Peter Azak's ties to the CIA,
right,
and to the other intelligence agencies, and how they were all, and exactly kind of what happened in that process, how they orchestrated the cover-up.
And you also have the footnotes live on your website so they can be updated. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Right. Because it really is a work in progress. Okay, well, I'm going to jump on those translations as soon as I get them.
I mean, Catherine, there's one other thing that I would mention. The hostility toward this book in the mainstream media is beyond question or dispute.
Right, but they can't find anything to criticize. They just have to make up names and you know.
So it's all ad hominem attacks against me, a conspiracy theorist, a liar, a grifter, all of these things.
No, it's worse now. Now you're successful. That was the last one I saw. What? The whole complaint was you and Children's Health Defense are successful. People love you and they're supporting you.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. But, you know, the gratifying thing to me is that to date, nobody has identified a factual error in the book. It's a 250,000 word book.
Right.
With 2,200 footnotes. And if there were errors in it, even small errors, it would be headlines, because that would be what they would focus on. Oh, that this is, you know, there's a lot of wrong information, but it's very, very strange. As there's going to be an error in the book. You cannot write, no book in history of that length has ever been published without at least some errors. You just make errors. And, you know, we were really, really careful, and we have a very rigorous fact-checking operation that's, you know, with seasoned veterans and ruthless fact-checking that went on. But I'm still going to make an error.
Right.
And but so far, none have been identified, and that's been very gratifying to me.
That is great. That's amazing. Okay, so let's talk about the global war on public health, because you, in the title, you describe a global war on public health and a global war on democracy. Both we've been calling the coup d'etat. If you look early in the book, what you describe are two things. You describe the extraordinary amount of spending and grants by Fauci once he arrives at the National Institute bureaucracy of almost $1 trillion, billion. So it's almost $1 trillion since 1984. During the same period, though, we see childhood chronic disease explode, significant slides in IQ and falling life expectancy. And I would add growth in economic inequality coming in part from health, the deterioration of health. So what you're describing is somebody is throwing around more and more money as health slides. Is that fair to say?
I think what I describe is a hijack of the public health institutions in this country and other countries, so that they no longer, the international institutions like WHO and, you know, the European Medical Agency, and then the creation of these quasi-governmental institutions by Gates and Fauci and Jeremy Farrar, like CEPI and Gavi and the Brighton collaboration, all of these other institutions that people kind of think create global health policy. Right. And that these institutions no longer do public health.
Right.
It's a fiction to say that they do public health. They do pharmaceutical promotion. So right. They have become hijacked through this captured medical technocracy led by Tony Fauci and Bill Gates. They have become captured by the pharmaceutical industry, and their purpose now is to capture public money flows, foreign aid flows that used to go to economic development, to public health, to sanitation, to hygiene, to agriculture, to take that, to capture all of that, and deploy it in a way that force it to change policies, to require or force developing countries to take lots of pharmaceutical drugs, and then to funnel public wealth to the pharmaceutical industry to pay for those expenses. And what we've seen is that the drugs do not make people healthy.
Right.
They make them sicker. And so they have this feedback loop where we are creating a chronic disease epidemic. We've essentially parlayed fear of infectious disease into a chronic disease epidemic pandemic, which then creates more wealth for the industry. Because if you get measles, what is the cure for measles? You know, I had measles with my 10 brothers and sisters when we were a kid, and when we were kids, and it was, you know, a week at home watching Sea Hunt and, you know, and having pillow fights.
Uh-huh.
And what was the treatment? The treatment is vitamin A and chicken soup, neither of which would be patented.
Right.
But if you give people a measles vaccine and 1 in 1,000 of those get seizures and 1 in 1,000 of those have lifetime epilepsy, and now you have a lifetime commitment.
Cash flow.
And so, you know, the chronic disease rate when Tony Fauci came into office among American children was 6%.
Right.
What do I mean by chronic disease? One, obesity, but mainly neurodevelopmental diseases, ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette's syndrome, and all these, narcolepsy, ASD and autism, all these diseases that we didn't know about prior to 1989. Nobody heard of autism before Rain Man came out in 88.
Right.
And the vaccine schedule changed in 89. And all, there's other toxics as well, clearly right. exposures that are causing these. So you have the neurodevelopmental disease, you have the autoimmune diseases like lupus, like Graves' disease, Crohn's disease, juvenile diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis that exploded again in 1989. And then you also have the allergic disease, like peanut allergies, anaphylaxis, eczema that suddenly appear and go pandemic in 1989. We went from 6% of our population having those diseases to 54%. Tony Fauci's job is as the head of the National Institute of Allergic and Infectious Diseases, is to track the etiology, the pathology of those illnesses, to find out what environmental exposure is causing. And we know it has to be an environmental exposure.
Right.
Genes do not cause epidemics. Something right. happened, and we know it was 1989 because Congress told the EPA, tell us what year the autism epidemic began. Autism went from 1 in 10,000 in my generation, which it is today. You do not see 68-year-old men walking around the mall with diapers and helmets and, you know, stimming and nonverbal, non-toilet trained. You know, I've never seen anybody like that my age,
right.
ever. And yet, 1 in 34 kids my children's age look like that. So right. what happened? And Congress said to EPA, what year did it start? And the EPA scientists came back and said, it's a red line, 1989.
Right.
And all of these diseases, if you look back, these diseases were invisible prior to 1989. After 1989, they're now part of our lives. They're normal
right.
lives.
Right.
What happened? Tony Fauci's job is to figure out what happened and then protect us from it. But he does the opposite. If people, these are easy things to figure out because there's a guy, Catherine, called Phil Landrigan, who's a famous toxicologist in New York at Mount Sinai. And I've actually used him in a number of, as an expert witness in a number of cases. He did the lead case, a very famous guy. And he's very pro-vaccine. But he did an article in which he said, what is the environmental toxin? Because here are the universe of things that it could be. You need a toxin that became ubiquitous in 1989. That affects every demographic from Cubans in Key Biscayne, Miami, to Inuit in Alaska. And there's some other characteristics that are kind of unique, is that particularly with the neurodevelopmental disorders, they affect boys at a 4-to-1 ratio to girls. So there's only a few things that do that. He took all of the possible, I think he came up with 11 of them. And there were things like PFOAs, which is a flame retardant that became ubiquitous in kids' pajamas and furniture around the same time. A glyphosate pesticide, herbicide, which again became ubiquitous on that timeline, neonicotinoid pesticides, ultrasound, which became ubiquitous at that time as well. There's a famous scientist at UC Davis at the Mine Institute called Irva Hertz-Pachona. And I had this conversation with her several years ago. And I said, what do you think it is? Which one of these? And she said, I think it's ultrasound. Oh, I don't believe it's ultrasound. I don't think it has anything to do with it. But, you know, there's some evidence that it should be looked at.
Right.
Cell phones.
Right.
And Wi-Fi. So there's a number of exposures that happen on that timeline. It's a really easy, basic science to look at the existing databases, to do bench studies, animal studies, and figure this out. You could do it in a couple of months. They're giving away, Francis Collins is giving away $42 billion a year to do research.
but they can't figure it out.
Fauci is giving $7.6 billion a year. And they will not give money to answer that question. And if a scientist on his own tries to do those studies, which are easy, because you think about this, how would you do that study? Let's say you suspected vaccines may be causing Tourette's syndrome or autism or whatever. It's easy to figure it out. Because all the HMOs have these vast databases, like the Kaiser here in California, they have all the vaccine records for millions of Californians and all their medical claims. So they can do a cluster analysis and correlate, you know, the particular vaccines that particular people got, and see if there's an association with diabetes, with rheumatoid arthritis, with ADD, ADHD. It's an easy, easy study. Well, if a scientist tries to do that study, he's going to apply to NIH, because NIH controls 60% of the biomedical funding for research. As soon as Tony Fauci figures out this guy is trying to do that, the dean of that medical school is going to get a call from one of Fauci's cronies, from Cliff Lane or Hugh Auchincloss or one of these other people, saying, you better shut this joker down, because we do not want that study done, and we can bankrupt your university. And these medical schools are getting hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
And they've filled up overheads that are dependent on it.
Yeah, and now we have their emails.
Right,
in which we see how they do it, where, you know, Collins writes an email to Fauci saying, shut down these three scientists from these fringe scientists from Harvard, from Oxford, and Stanford, the leading epidemiologists in the world, shut them down with a devastating takedown, quote unquote. That's how they do it. That's how they made sure that we do not know what's causing all these problems to our children.
Right. It really is RICO. It really is RICO.
It is racketeering, but
I'm not saying you should prosecute it. I'm just saying it's a pattern.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things you go through that I really appreciate is you go through the extent of the regulatory capture and literally government employees making money from, you know, promoting and selling products. But one of the things you do is you help us understand how bad the mindset is by telling a couple of stories, one of which is Celia Farber's story of the foster children, and the other is the African atrocities. And I think that's important because it helps you understand the kind of mentality you're dealing with here. These are people who consider humans expendable.
Yeah, that is, I think, one of the most extraordinary features of what I would say, and I don't say this in the book, but I would say anybody who reads the book will see strong evidence of sociopathy, sociopathological behavior, of a willingness to dismiss vast human suffering as collateral damage that will, in areas where there is a career advancement at stake or a power expansion at stake for Dr. Fauci, that he is willing to make these terrible, terrible sacrifices of human beings.
And break laws. So here's
what, you know, the Celia Farber story is that when Fauci got AZT using fraud, as I show, he took a drug that was so toxic that it was regarded as unacceptable for chemotherapy. Now, cancer chemotherapy is usually a 2-week course, and you're giving somebody a highly toxic drug that will kill all of the cells in their body. And the hope is that it will kill the tumor cells before it kills the rest of you. And that's how chemotherapy, that's how conventional chemotherapy worked.
Right.
AZT was developed by the National Cancer Institute and then thrown on a junk heap because it was regarded as too toxic to give to cancer patients. And you're only giving them a 2-week course. Fauci and using fraud, which I show unambiguous in the book, got approval using bullying and fraud, got approval to give this to HIV infected Americans, people who weren't even sick, most of them, for life. So AZT killed 100% of the people who stayed on it. That's what it did. And it killed probably 330,000 people.
Right.
Made huge amounts of money for GlaxoSmithKline for what was then called Burroughs Wellcome. And so after that success story, he was trying to expand the markets. And he was trying to, Fauci was trying to expand the markets to children who had HIV. And ultimately, the African experiments were on to stop maternal transmission. So mothers, pregnant women who had AZT, you give them a chemotherapy drug that is highly toxic while they're pregnant and hope that the kids don't have HIV. And there's so much wrong with what they did. You really should have, you have to read the chapter to see it. But
right.
The first experiments that he did was to try to get approvals for using some of these drugs on children. And of course, no person in their right mind would allow their children to participate in that kind of experiment. So what he did is he got control of these foster homes in 7 states and then turned them over to the pharmaceutical companies. And he what they made sure was that there were no medical personnel there, and that the foster children did not have guardians who would have stopped it.
Right.
The people who were on site were not doctors or nurses. They were mainly highly vulnerable Dominican immigrants who really didn't know what was happening. They were just being told, give these kids these drugs. And many of them figured out that they were being told to poison these children.
Right.
The children themselves knew they were being poisoned and they fought it. And the bravery, we have now these films that Celia Farber helped make with a guy called Liam Sheff, who subsequently died, but for the BBC, where they interviewed the children who are, the older 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds, were trying to protect the 8-year-olds. Give them strategies when the children disobeyed Fauci's orders and refused to take the drugs, which were making them horrendously sick. They were sent to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital and they were feeding tubes installed in their stomachs so that the drugs could be directly injected into them, even when they would refuse to be compliant. And a lot of these kids died. We know at least 85 of them died. We also know, number one, it was completely illegal because they didn't have guardians. Number two, many of the children did not have HIV. So
right,
it was utterly illegal because you cannot do those experiments on kids. You can do medical testing of products on kids as long as you can say, well, there's a benefit. These kids are sick. They're going to die anyway. And this is a last hope drug. Then it becomes legal as long as there's a lot of safeguards applied. But in this case, Fauci and his partners were using children who weren't even sick. The right. only qualification they had is they had no adult to stand up for them. And we know that at least 85 of those children died in those experiments. Celia Farber, who's an extraordinary researcher who worked with me on that chapter, went up and found the cemetery, Gates of Heaven Cemetery in Hawthorne, New York. She found a pit that was filled with tiny little coffins. Some of them had multiple children in them. The pit was covered with an astroturf carpet, and she opened the carpet and looked inside and said, there may have been 1,000 little coffins in there. We know that 85 of those kids,
oh my God,
died in Fauci's experiments, but we have no idea what happened to the other one. Now, the interesting postscript is that 2 weeks ago, the Yonkers newspaper, the Yonkers Times, which is adjacent to Hawthorne, New York, printed an angry editorial by the editor, whose name is Dan Murphy. And he said, and the headline was, Robert F. Kennedy lied about the cemetery where my parents are buried. And then it went and said, you know, he told this story about all these children, and we checked with the Catholic Archdiocese, and the Catholic Archdiocese said the entire story was made up. So he printed that. We then went, you know, we went and pushed back and showed him the evidence, including aerial photos from, you know, from GPS, of the gravestones and of the grave, you know, of the burial area with the children's names on them. And the diocese then changed its story, and they asked the Yonkers Times to remove that story, which they did.
Wow. That's incredible.
Well, that's the one newspaper article that I've gotten challenged. The
facts. Well, you know, to me, this is a very important story because of two things. One is, if you look at the history of financial fraud, the reason it keeps getting worse is they keep getting away with it. And the more they get away with, the more hubris. You know, if you look at the gain of hubris over the 30 years, it's extraordinary. And if you look at what Tony Fauci and the machinery that he's a part of have been getting away with, the more they get away with this, the worse it gets. And so when people read this book and that story, they realize, oh, now I see how this could be happening, because this is a machinery that has grown and gotten progressively bigger and more powerful and worse and worse. So, again, it's unbelievably effective. Go ahead.
You've heard me say this, that there are three rules that if we want to restore our democracy, every American needs to understand. And the first rule is that every power the government takes, it will never give back,
right,
voluntarily, without a demand, without a confrontation. And so, when the government says, we will, you know, we're going to close you down for 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and we say, that's okay, well, we just gave them a power.
And they get worse.
They will immediately abuse the power, and they will never give it back. So even though, you know, right now we're living in an era, a brief, you know, interregnum where there are no lockdowns, they still now have that power to impose lockdowns anytime they want, forever. And they will never give that power up until we force them to do it. Number two, every power that they do take, they will ultimately abuse to the maximum extent possible. And that Tony Fauci's career, as you said, is just a parade of proof that that is true, that the abuse, it becomes worse and worse and more inhumane and murderous and genocidal and racist, which is throughout his career, it is consistently blacks who are the subjects of his experiments and Hispanics. Right. Number three, that nobody ever complied their way out of totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
People believe that, okay, if we just do this last thing that they're asking us to do, then they'll go away and we can go back to normal. And the opposite is true. It's a signal to them of what they can get away with and what the next step is. Every time you comply, their hubris gets, you know, inflated.
Absolutely worse.
And they, and that's why, you know, this today, the hill that you need to die on is the one you're on right now, because we're just going to keep pushing you back to weaker and weaker positions.
Well, but the other thing is, if you look at where people don't comply, so let's turn to the war on, the global war on democracy, where you don't, the place this has gotten backed up with people refuse to comply, and they're getting backed up again and again and again by people who just say no. So it's working. We just need a lot more people doing it. So let me jump in. Global War on Democracy, you do a great job in this book of connecting the dots between Fauci and this machinery and the war on public health with the intelligence agencies and a whole variety of other players who are centralizing power. And because you take the time to go through the detail, you really see this spider web developing and growing. So maybe say a little bit about the, you know, the history of fake or sort of organized pandemics and the simulations.
You know, a lot of people, first of all, you know, the kind of the coalition that we end up looking at, which are these, you know, these groups of actors who are centralizing power, as you put it, are, you know, you have to look at cui bono, who is benefiting. Clearly, the Silicon Valley billionaire. We've seen this huge shift in wealth, $3.8 trillion from the global working class and middle class to this new class of billionaires. Many of them have wealth and power that is rooted in new technologies and Silicon Valley. And coincidentally, many of those have deep ties to the intelligence community. And right. They go through the history of NQTEL and the CIA role and the intelligence agencies and military role in developing the ARPANET grid in 1979 and then making these big investments in thousands of Silicon Valley companies that are now dominating that space. And the, you know, the ironic thing that people need to see is that the very people who are censoring the dissent and criticism of the lockdown policies are the same people who are making billions on those policies. So the Bill Gates and Jeffrey Bezos and Jeff Mark Zuckerberg, Sergey Brin, Larry Ellison, all of these, you know, these companies are profiting from closing all the small businesses in our country.
Of course. And they're stealing market share.
Right. And so we should be suspicious. These companies, these titans who promised us that they were going to democratize communications globally, and that they've now become the primary interest for the emerging totalitarian state.
Right.
And they're, you know, they're actively censoring the any discussion in the public square, which they control.
Right.
Any dissent to these policies that are making them richer and richer and richer and more powerful. And they have close relationships that I show in the book to the intelligence community. Now, I kind of stumbled onto this notion by, you know, onto this, what I would say, truth, by looking at, beginning with a focus on Event 201.
Right.
Oh, Event 201 is, you know, a pandemic simulation that took place in October of 2019. And it took place at the Pierre Hotel in New York. It's hosted by Bill Gates and two other interesting people. Avril Haines, who's the deputy director, former deputy director of the CIA, she's now the top spy in our country. And she's Joe Biden's chief advisor on coronavirus. And she's a CIA agent, officer.
Right.
She made her bones by covering up, by destroying the evidence, you know, in Abu Ghraib with the torture tapes, and by destroying the tapes when the CIA was illegally spying on the United States Senate. And she made the decision as chief counsel to destroy that evidence. So that was an assault on democracy, what she did. And she was rewarded with that by becoming the highest spy in the country. Now, the big question is, why is the CIA involved with the public health issue, crisis? The CIA doesn't do public health.
Right.
The CIA does coup d'etats.
Right.
Between 1947 and 1997, the CIA was involved in 73 coup d'etats against one third of the governments in the world, almost all of them democracies. So the CIA is not a friend of democracy. And so why are they involved in this? Now, the other person who is involved, which is strange, is George Gale, the head of the Chinese CDC. So he's one of those. What, and you, we have to remember, this is October of 2019. The National Security Agency believes that coronavirus began circulating on by at least by September 12th, 2019. The world didn't know about it until the end of December. But the Chinese government apparently did. And the reason we know that is because satellite surveillance shows the parking lots of the hospital in Wuhan were filled up jam tight beginning on September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
There were technicians in the lab who ended up a couple of weeks later in those hospitals with symptoms that are coronavirus symptoms. That night, there was chatter all over the internet beginning that day of people getting mad, trying to look for masks, people figuring out how to treat symptoms of what we now know are COVID symptoms in Wuhan. And that night, the Chinese military broke into the Wuhan lab, removed 22,000 coronavirus samples, which have never been seen again. And they removed the gain of function studies, including the ones that were funded by NIH, from the public facing websites. And they installed a military commander in the lab. So the supposition is that the Chinese government knew by September 12th that they had a problem, that there had been a jailbreak, essentially, of one of these creatures that they had been creating there, one of these pandemic superbugs. So this is a month later in New York, and you have George Gale, who is co-hosting this event with Bill Gates and the head of the CIA.
So can I just point out one thing? It was August 22nd, 2019. So August, the end of August at Jackson Hole, where all the G7 central bankers voted on the going direct reset. And September, the Fed goes into the market and kicks it off, which is basically a global economic takedown. And then we go into 201.
Yeah.
So these things are happening at the same time.
Yeah. And they, so what are they doing there? They're not, this is supposed to be a pandemic simulation.
Right.
The most notable occurrence is that nobody's talking about public health. They're all talking about how do you use a pandemic as a pretense for imposing totalitarian controls, censorship, lockdowns, masks. Nobody's talking about how do we get vitamin D to all the people? How do we create a communications grid with the 11 million frontline physicians in countries like Zambia and Bangladesh and France and Argentina who are going to be treating these, in Italy, treating these patients, figuring out on their own, here's what works. How do we get that information back to a central repository and then distribute it so that we can develop protocols for avoiding hospitalizations, avoiding deaths, avoiding the pandemic? There's no discussion of anything like that. There's no discussion of how do you get zinc to people? How do you start people losing weight and taking care of themselves and building their immune systems and all of the kind of thing? And then how do you quarantine the sick? You know, right. Where do we put the sick and where do we put the vulnerable so we can protect the sick, protect the, isolate the sick, protect the vulnerable, maintain our constitutional rights, which everybody knows are going to be, you know, at play during a pandemic. There's no talk of any of that. It's all about how do we get the social media sites to censor dissent? How do we lock down people? How do we impose a police state? And the fourth simulation that day is a simulation about all about censorship. How do you get social media? And the people who are there are ambassadors for the social media companies, the mainstream media companies, the, you know, the big pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, the military. And they're talking about how do you, I mean, the fourth simulation is really interesting because the principal preoccupation, which is raised initially by George Gale, is if people start saying that this is a lab-generated coronavirus, remember, they're simulating a coronavirus pandemic that is spreading across the world. And George Gale says, what if people start saying on the internet that this is laboratory-generated? We need to shut them up. And so in light of, you know, what happened after that, which we now know the Chinese were conspiring with, directly with Anthony Fauci, Peter Daszak, Jeremy Farrar, to silence that talk, to make sure nobody talked about it, to say that anybody who talked about it was a conspiracy theorist and that they were crazy and they should be evicted. And that's exactly what they did. So anyway, when I started looking at event 201 and following the threads, what I learned was that this was not a one-off event, that I was able to find about at least a dozen other of these events that have been continuously staged by the CIA since the year 2000. The first one was called Dark Winter, and incidentally, Dark Winter is a simulation of an anthrax attack on our country. And three or four months after that simulation, we have the anthrax attacks. And
what a remarkable coincidence.
Right. And what happens with the anthrax attacks? The anthrax attacks are then used, blamed on Saddam Hussein, and used as a pretense to launch the Iraq war and to pass the Patriot Act, which gave the intelligence agencies these broad new powers. And who is targeted by the anthrax? Two senators, Gary Hart and Richard Leahy. Why? What did those two senators have in common? They were leading the battle to stop the Patriot Act.
Right.
And so they're attacked. Their resistance to the Patriot Act and withers. And the Patriot Act is then, you know, hammered through with nobody reading it. Literally, Michael Moore was able to show not a single person had read it. And it gave all these new powers. And then what do we find out? That the anthrax did not come from Saddam Hussein. The FBI's investigation said it could only have come from one of three U.S. labs that are run by the intelligence agencies and the United States military.
Right.
And so, but what we found is that these simulations continued year after year after year, and every one of them has one thing in common. They're all scripted by the CIA. Two, there are high-level CIA officials at every one of them. Three, most of them have a, what I would call a useful idiot, a very prominent person who gives the imprimatur of legitimacy to it. So they bring in Madeleine Albright or Sam Nunn, who's, you know, the chairman of the Defense Committee, or Gary Hart, or some congressman, or Bill Gates, so that everybody says, oh yeah, this isn't just a rogue group. These are legitimate mainstream people. And they involved hundreds of thousands of people involved in these simulations. It wasn't just a handful of 40 people. They were doing these in cities across Europe, the United States, and Canada simultaneously. They were bringing in the police forces, the frontline workers, the hospital systems, the public utilities. They were all classified. They were a secret. The public didn't know these were happening. But hundreds and thousands of people in your community were involved. And what they were basically doing is they were getting a sign off from these people. They were saying, here's what you do when there's a pandemic. Forget about public health. The appropriate response is to impose totalitarian controls.
Right.
And because they were doing this year after year, you know, all of these normal people were inducted into this groupthink where a lot of them probably said, this is a really weird response to a pandemic, but yeah, I'm looking around and all the people I know are doing it. So, and you know, it seems legitimate. So this, I guess this is what we do. And then, you know, when the pandemic did happen and we were all sitting around saying, how the heck did all the liberal democracies in the world suddenly pivot in lockstep? Right. And do the exact same thing. Why weren't any of them doing anything different? Why weren't any of them experimenting with different systems? Why was there no laboratories for different ways of doing it? Why did they all sign on to this, you know, totalitarian response? And I think the clear answer is that, you know, they had been drilling this. They were using these psychological warfare techniques. And that's, you know, if you look at what
I have to say, I haven't tracked health, but if you look in the financial area over many, many decades, when you build up to all the fraud in the financial crisis for 20 years, for two decades from 1996 on, they were pushing out the ethical people and promoting up the people who would promote the fraud. And it took about two or three decades, but by the time you got from 96 to 20, you know, you had a whole world of people at the top who were pretty willing to rock and roll with you.
You know, Catherine, that's exactly when I asked Robert Malone to read the book. You know, he was one of the people that I asked to fact check the book, and he read it, and that was the, I think that was one of the most astute and enlightening comments that he came back. And he didn't say this to me, but he wrote somebody else in describing the book. He said, there's been this systematic, there's some people in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, who use a mantra that policy is personnel.
Right.
And that, you know, the written policy is irrelevant. It's right. The people who are administering it that are everything. And what Malone said is there was this systematic effort to weed out people who, you know, who had essentially moral character. The people who would say, wait a minute, you can't do that.
Right.
Now, I know right from wrong. This is wrong, and I'm not going to go along with it. And those people are all systematically removed.
Right. And it took decades.
What? Yeah.
It took decades. It was not, you know, you had a lot of people.
And it becomes self-perpetuating.
Right.
Because you get the guy who is the chair of the department. Who is corrupt, and he's teaching everybody else, training them in that culture of corruption, and that's, you know.
Right. And they don't even think of it as corrupt. They think this is the way it is. You just go with the. So let me turn to the vision of democracy. One of the reasons I love listening to your speeches, is you remember it. You bring us out of the trance and. You have such confidence that democracy works. You believe in democracy. You have spent a lifetime dealing and learning the nuts and bolts of democracy, because democracy is very hard work. It's very messy. It's complicated. It's hard work. But you have such a faith in it that when I listened to you, I was like, right, I remember what it was like to be with a group of people who believe in democracy. And I think that that faith and that vision is so important for us to have and capture. So I just want you to describe, why is it that you are so sure democracy can work?
Well, I'm not sure democracy can work. In fact, you know, my father was always really clear on this, that democracy, and the founders were too, that it is a really, we think of these, because our institutions are old and sturdy and, you know, they have these very, you know, the alabaster city on a hill with these very solid monuments that tell us, yeah, the Supreme Court is there. It's made of pure marble. You can't move it. It is rooted and it will never go away. But my father was constantly cautioning, and my uncle, President Kennedy, that democracy was a very fragile system,
right,
and that it had to be constantly renewed, and that every generation had to be vigilant about making sure that we supported these institutions and made them work and subject them to scrutiny. And so, but, you know, and I don't have any, you know, particular, I know there are other systems that have worked during different parts of history. And that have worked very well, you know, during different parts of history. But what Franklin said is that democracy is the worst possible system, but it's the best one that we got.
Right.
And it's the most reliable one if you want, if you value personal freedom and personal creativity and individual rights. You know, it's hard to find a system that is going to be more reliably protect those values. Now, I have some faith in democracy because we have lost it before in this country. We lost it during the 1880s, during the Gilded Age. And, you know, at that point, you had these very, very unprecedented wealth come along. John D. Rockefeller is still the richest person in human history. If you measure his wealth, you know, against the sort of the metrics of the time, he's far richer than Gates is today. You know, he owned 80% of the oil production in the world, essentially. And they also, at that time, there was no direct election of senators. So the robber barons could by the state legislature. It was said of the Pennsylvania state legislature at that time, somebody said that the Pennsylvania legislature was not, none of them were for sale because John D. Rockefeller owned them all and he wasn't selling them. So, you know, but they were all corrupt. The legislatures in most of the states were horrendously corrupt and they appointed the senators. Well, the Robert Barons were literally appointing the U.S. senators, and there was no income taxes at that time, you know, so that wealth was not taxed. There was no corporate taxes. There was no antitrust legislation. There were no child labor laws. Women could not vote. There was no work week, mandatory work week. People were working 7 hours slave labor, 7 days, 20, you know, 12 hours slave labor. And you had this confluence of reform efforts, which I think is what we have to look at today. You had a populist movement in the countryside, in the rural areas. You had which was democratic. You had a progressive movement in the cities that was Republican. You had muckraking journalists, which is something that's utterly absent today. And I think that is critical. And, you know, like Ida Tarbell, Sinclair Lewis.
It's amazing. Amazing.
Right. McClure's magazine. You had these extraordinary. And then you had one really charismatic leader, which was Teddy Roosevelt. And there was other ones too. You know, Taft also was willing to stand up at least to some extent to the big corporations, and they passed the Sherman Antitrust Act. In 1908, they passed a law that made it illegal for corporations to give to federal political candidates, and that was critical. That held for 100 years until the Citizens United case in 2008. And you had the antitrust laws, you had the breakup of Standard Oil, and the 40-hour work week, the women got the vote, and we essentially restored democracy. And then that sort of continued with strengthening the unions as a counterbalance to the corporations up through the Great Depression and World War II. And so we have restored it before. Now, the big question now is can we restore it now, given the additional obstacle of these technological instrumentalities that have become weapons of totalitarian control? So what we're seeing now is the imposition of what I call turnkey totalitarianism, and it's a phrase you and I have talked a lot about, where they're installing all of these capacities that give them powers that no totalitarian system in history
has ever had. So they're turning our homes and communities into digital concentration camps.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So what are they? It's 415,000 low orbit satellites that will look at every square inch of the Earth every bit of the day, and with heat profiles and all this. So Anne Frank can no longer hide in the attic. They're going to know where she is. They are facial recognition systems that can read emotions. Now, the Chinese have deployed a system that can read guilt on people's faces, so it's a pre-crime system. You have, probably the most insidious is the vaccine passport, because what that does automatically is it takes all of these rights that we have. We do, as imperfect as our system have, you have a right to go to a bowling alley tonight, or a bar, or a sport event, or get on a plane and fly to Las Vegas, and or drive to San Francisco. But once you get that passport, all of those rights now become privileges that are contingent upon your compliance, your obedience with government diktats.
Right.
And those diktats can be completely arbitrary, as they have been the whole year. There's no public hearing. There's no show of evidence. There's no scientific demonstrations. It's just one guy, an unelected official who's been there for 50 years, who says, put on the mask, and I'm not going to show you why. I'm not going to show you any science. I don't have to, because I am science. And, that is very, very troublesome. The question is, now we're kind of in an arms race where you're seeing the resistance on our side building.
Right.
And, you're seeing literally millions of people coming out of the street. But you're also seeing these instrumentalities of control in this escalating arms race, that ultimately, if they get them all in place, even 100% resistance will become irrelevant.
Right.
Because, listen, you saw those pictures. You and I see the pictures of the civil war that's going now in Queensland, Australia. The, half a million people gathering in the downtown Vienna.
Right.
The marches that go on for miles, the drone flights over the marchers in Paris and everywhere else.
It's incredible. But
most of my friends in liberal Hollywood have no idea any of that's happening. None. Right. None. And, because it's not because the media is blocking And it's like, you know, Emerson said, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it actually fall? Well, if the riots happen and the demonstrations happen and nobody knows about them, they didn't happen.
Right.
And, everybody is happy and we're all living in 1984, but it's, now.
So the people who don't see that happening don't see the trap they're about to fall into themselves.
No, and this is one of the this is the big problem. And I talked to Matthias Desmet, professor from Ghent, who's gotten a lot of attention recently because he talks about mass formation and about the this hypnotic effect of fear and isolation. And when you get populations that are fearful, where fear can be manipulated, and when there's a high level of isolation, well, people don't feel that their lives are meaningful, that they're that they have rich social relationships, or that there's other ways of isolating them, which means wear a mask, don't come out of your house, don't go to schools. Those people go into a state of hypnosis that becomes impenetrable, where they are no longer susceptible to evidence, to reason, and that they only have one prerogative, which is compliance and an adherence to a dominant narrative that appears to solve, that promises to solve their problems and give them coherence.
So his theories to me explain about 1% of what's going on, because if you look at the nuts and bolts of the control that each individual is subject to, it's much more complex, effective, and individually controlling. So it's not just, it's not just a psychosis coming from fear. They're subject to amazing day-to-day controls from a covert social credit system, which is very, very invasive and has been for a long time. It's just, it's coming to fruition in an unbelievably powerful way.
I think that's a really good point, Catherine. I think that's, one of the great contributions that you've made to our understanding of what's happening now is which most of us are ignoring, which is that, this social credit system and the manipulation of that system by the big financial houses that ultimately are probably, the bedrock reason that all this is happening.
Right. And what happened to me is I moved to a poor or sort of a lower income farming community many years ago, and I watched how that system is organized. Both there are many different aspects. Health is important, but the financial one is the most important, and it's amazing. It's really very much engineered with AI and software, but the amount of control they can deliver is remarkable. It's a little bit like having a round-the-clock Stasi team on you, but it's AI and software. It's not humans. I don't know. Have you ever seen what's that great movie about The Lives of Others? It's about an artist in, I think it was Poland, who's under 24/7 Stasi, or East Germany, who's under 24/7 Stasi. And I kind of feel like we're in our lives, the lives of other, except it's AI and software. Anyway. So tell us what we can do, because I think what you're saying is absolutely right. We have this, the pushback versus the totalitarianism. And I think it's unbelievably important. You say resist, resist, resist. Tell us what we can do right now, this month, this year, to resist, to resist, resist.
Well, here's what I would say to people is that the optimistic way to look at this is that there's a huge conversion taking place right now where people are waking up out of this psychosis.
Right.
And they are understanding the narrative, and the it's a cascading effect. There are more and more people every day who are joining the resistance, and we are involved in asymmetrical warfare. We are fighting a force that controls all the major institutions of our society, the military, the intelligence agencies, the media companies, the social media companies, the Congress, the regulatory agencies, all the way down to the doctors and the hospitals, etc. And, you know, they're all mobilized to impose this narrative on us and to impose totalitarian control. So the optimistic part of that is, you know, what happens to totalitarian regimes ultimately is that historically they've all ultimately collapsed.
Right.
That is a message of hope. How does it happen? It happens that that large numbers of people begin escaping the narrative. And we're seeing that cascading effect now. And one of the sources of optimism is that the conversions are 100% in favor of the resistance. So nobody goes back into the matrix. Nobody from our side says, okay, I don't want to be part of this thing. I'm going to go back in and, you know, and take the bribes and do and, you know, immerse myself in the social credit system. It's really, it's a race about how do you get to the tipping point where so many people are resisting that the institutions begin to crumble. And it's an asymmetrical war, so our advantage is agility. It's looking for opportunistic targets, you know, finding cracks in the foundation and exploiting them, and then converting people and converting them one person at a time. And that is really how it's going to work, is that everybody, what I tell people is you need to go out and do 3 civil disobediences a day, everybody. And what that means is you talk to other people who you wouldn't talk to, and you expose them to these ideas.
Right.
You don't have to do it in an aggressive way. You can do it in a peaceful way, but you constantly expose people to new ideas. The reason propaganda works, you know, Goebbels said this, that propaganda the optimal form of propaganda is the big lie.
Right.
Why the big lie? Because once people swallow the big lie, they are very reluctant to relinquish it. And Mark Twain explained why. He said that it's much easier to fool somebody and to persuade somebody that they've been fooled. So once they've swallowed the big lie, they do not want to relinquish it. They do not want to admit they were wrong. And that is the major force of inertia in these systems, is not unwillingness. Are all these people who made a hero of Anthony Fauci to suddenly say everything he said was a lie? People don't want to do that. So the way, and then, the, you know, the problem for Goebbels was, how do you get people to believe the big lie? And he said it's formulaic. You tell it to them 5 times. The first 4 times, they won't believe it. The 5th time, they believe it. And so what our job is to tell all of those people who believe the big lie a counter narrative 5 times. So you, every time you run to anybody, you tell them the counter narrative. We have stickers at CHD. We have a template of informational stickers that tell people the counter narrative and give them the reasons they should start doubting. It's just so doubt inside of their minds. You can print this out on your home printer on paper that you get from Kinko's or from, you know, FedEx or Staples that has a stick on the back.
Right.
And when you go leave your house in the morning, bring one of those, bring one of those with 10 stickers on it and put them up in different places where people are going to see them. Because we need all those people who heard Anderson Cooper lie to them five times or Jake Tapper. We need them to hear our side five times. And we need to constantly be recruiting from the other side and bringing them over one person at a time, one person at a time. And we, we're now at 35% who are on our side. And when we get to 51%, the tipping point is going to be somewhere right there.
And from what I'm seeing, it's growing quickly.
Yeah.
It's compounding. I do, I have to do this because I am an investment banker. I want to suggest that handing out this book is one of the most effective things I've ever done. People read it and they understand how they swallowed the big lie. And then they flip the narrative. It really cuts through the fog of war. So a sticker works with some people, but there are a lot of people we've got to turn who, when they read this book, they will flip, because the evidence is so overwhelming and the read is so interesting. So I just have to tell them, buy the book, read the book, get five copies, hand them out. At some point, because, I want to see this as number one in the true crime category. The more this book sells, the more they will not be able to push the big lie. I think it's very, very important that we continue to support the sales and make sure people are reading this book, because it's working. It works.
Thank you, Catherine.
No, thank you, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Thank you for joining us on the Solaria Report. You have a wonderful day. And again, anything we can do to support you and your efforts, just let us know. We're there.
Likewise. Thank you, Catherine, for all that you do. I've learned so much from you. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye.